Okay, questions, please.
Nobody else wants to go.
Go. Question for Paul. It's really just a point of clarification. So, that paper was very, very interesting, but I was wondering if you could expand on what you think are the features of anarchism that make it an appropriate methodology and epistemology for the study of terrorism. Your paper suggested it, but towards the end, it was left unclear about what you actually saw as being benefits.
I think there's more work that I could do there. It's where I would profit from having a partner or input from events like this. I touched on some that I think anarchists aren't part of this rather fixed left-right paradigm that seems to be emerging, both within terrorism studies and indeed wider debates around Islam and Islamism in the UK. I think what I'm really calling for is the ability to walk and chew gum at the same time, the ability to be critical of government and to be critical of non-state actors. And anarchists have managed that with national liberation movements in the past. I found some old stuff, the Freedom newspaper had written on the Algerian struggle for independence. And there was questioning there, where exactly is this going? You found that in anarchist approaches to Irish republicanism. Where are these groups going? What do they want? What type of society will they create? And it's what worries me about a lot of the discourse about the Middle East and Israel is I can tell you exactly the type of society Hamas will create. It will look like much of the rest of the Muslim world, and you probably don't want to go there. And I think anarchists are capable of pointing that out, are capable of arguing those points, and I think some from other disciplines probably aren't. And so that really is the contribution that I feel we can make. But there's a huge amount of work to be done yet.
I really respect the Paul's thing about coming out against Islamic extremism, and I think Antifa is probably one of the few groups that is maintaining a dual critique kind of thing, which I really respect as well. I suppose one of the questions that I have about this, this notion that terrorism is a method, you're saying terrorism is a method. If terrorism is a method, should we talk about violent tactics? Because terrorism, shouldn't we discard the term terrorism altogether? Because terrorism is a method that anarchists use. We use violent tactics, but we don't want it to be pejoratively termed as terrorism, because terrorism is a statist way of giving a pejorative signifier to violent tactics. So I wonder if anarchists can even meaningfully use the term terrorism at all.
Defining terrorism has proved extremely problematic for virtually anybody who's entered into the field to try and do it. So, I mean, I think at one point the United States government had four different definitions of terrorism across different departments. A very clear distinction is made in the UK between what they refer to as domestic extremism and terrorism. And domestic extremism appears to centre on countering direct action and animal rights extremism. And terrorism is also on another shelf up here. The use of deadly violence, the use of guns and explosives. It's become, there was a conference on the government's Prevent scheme quite recently, and there's been some blurring of that distinction, really. And Prevent basically started out as a government scheme to counter radicalisation of young Muslims following 7/7. Muslim community organisations were unhappy, felt they were being stigmatised, and so animal rights extremism and far-right extremism was added to the bill, so to speak, and Prevent concentrated on the three. And I argued at this conference it's a nonsense, because really you've got only one of those three currents is really killing people, and that is a distinction I think is acceptable to make. I mean, I was founder member of Antifa, who you mentioned, member of class war for 16 years, not interested in killing anybody. Smashing a few windows, disrupting fascist events, yes. I think it is legitimate. I do think it is legitimate to make that distinction between the deadly use of violence, and indeed the deadly use of violence against non-targeted individuals, which is the characteristic of events like 7/7, 9/11. It's anyone will do, it's not just civilians, it's anybody.
So assassination is not terrorism.
You're going to have entirely different... It's the use of deadly violence for political purposes. So I think the vast majority of researchers will say, yes, it is. If anarchists wish to argue differently...
Yes.
Well,
you know, you have this in classical anarchism, obviously. We can go back to Malatesta in the 1890s, who wrote about against Ravachol and so on, and against Henri, and Merriman had written a book about actually was at that conference. And what he was saying is basically that mass anonymous terrorism is a form of authoritarianism, which just increases the power of the state, makes people cower, and actually reinforces a kind of hierarchy between the bomber and the innocent victims in the street. So he was against that, although assassination is a bit more ambiguous. I don't think he shed many tears when Gaetano Bresci assassinated the king of Italy in 1900, and he was very cagey about that. And certainly not if they tried to kill Mussolini, and certainly wouldn't have shed any tears if they got rid of him. So I think it's very complicated. Also, terrorism, in terms of the 19th century, there were plenty of liberals in this country who said that when the populace carried out acts of terror in Russia, that was okay because Russia was not a constitutional state. And therefore, you were actually legitimate. They argued in support of letting these people off. They shouldn't be punished for these acts because they were forced to do it in a state that didn't allow them democratic. So even liberals can sometimes openly endorse terrorism. The other point is that you have state terrorism, which is the biggest form of terrorism, Stalinist terrorism, French Revolution, whatever. And if you want to read a good piece that talks about this, is this Martin Miller's piece about it with Danse Macabre. I don't know, it's not the title he finally used, but it's in the Journal of Study of Radicalism about terrorism, and also Mark Mazower on state violence in one of the big history journals, the same thing, state violence in the 20th century.
Okay, I've got about five or six people waiting at the moment. Does anybody want to come in on this point specifically? Yeah?
I would continue from there, then
make another point
afterwards, because I was going to raise the same question about the terrorism as a method, and certainly from maybe the just following on from that, the perspective of the state certainly is, and so maybe particularly the democratic state, that anarchist approaches to politics, much of the stuff that we've been talking about, is inherently violent, militant, because it doesn't acknowledge the institutions that are there it sort of steps outside the framework in which you can make legitimate demand, and so from a perspective of the state, it will always be in some way violent, even if it isn't explicitly violent. So I think from the perspective of the state, then, hence there is no real ability to differentiate between people who are bombing, who are pursuing political aims of direct violence, or people who might just be challenging radically indirect action, certain things. So I think that the perspective of the state, which makes it difficult, of course, to have a discourse on terrorism from an anarchist perspective, but I take a challenge. I have another question that's been with me for since yesterday, really. It was partly a question for all of us, but Chris' paper prompted it, which is the question of the law, or like the role of the law in all this, because law is so important in international relations, and it's maybe that one area, international law, that also transcends the state to in the sense of being an institution that, whether it's regarded or not, as yielding some kind of power. And the activists you're describing, they are appealing to this, aren't they? They're appealing to the law, and they're trying to put the battle onto that field. I think it's an interesting area to explore for anarchist thought, really. How's the relation to the law? Because we all know how we relate to the state. Don't like the state, but then how do we relate to the law? And what is the law?
Paul, did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, I think it is worth reiterating that anarchists came to broadly reject propaganda by deed, and they came to reject it as a method for changing society. And the majority focus of anarchist organisations in my lifetime has been around attempting to move towards a mass, or you know, a large group uprising type approach towards revolution. It hasn't been the armed group approach. For very simple reason, it didn't work. Just on the states, I think it is important to reiterate what the state's focus will always be. And the example I give here, the 7/7 occurred on a Thursday. On the Saturday, there was a huge police operation at King's Cross, where obviously most of the bodies had been removed, but it was just 48 hours from King's Cross attack. And that police operation was to take pictures of activists returning from Scotland from the demonstration against the G8. Huge police operation, and people were stunned and were getting off the trains, shouting and swearing at the police, saying, what the bloody hell are you playing at? You know, this is the focus that they have. That they're almost stuck in sort of a mindset that they can't particularly change out of. So I think the state will always see us probably as a bigger threat than we actually are, to be brutally honest, for political reasons.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a massive question, and there's no I can say that isn't going to be wrong in so many ways. What's interesting to me when looking at anti-Armstrong movement is the way in which these questions are approached, both in terms of tactics when you get arrested and things like that, but wider tactics in terms of you want a jury, and so any activist that's done any criminal damage will know the amount of damage you have to cause to guarantee a jury. And the way in which that is approached. So I think it's interesting the way in which people always try to prefigure the law they want to be dealing with and such. And I wonder if there's something there. I don't know where you could take that, but I wonder if there's something fun to have there. And I think it links quite interestingly with the way in which the police are approached. And the Raytheon 9, when the police broke into the office they were in after, I think, an eight-hour siege outside, found the nine of them sitting around the table playing cards. And I think there were about 25, 30 police, many of them armed, and started screaming, you know, get on the floor and such. And they very determinedly carried on playing cards and created this beautiful sort of tableau of not performing what the police expected to, but also making the police perform this sort of ridiculous charade of the protectors of militarism. And so I think the way in which we engage with the police and can subvert that, and the way in which we engage with the law and can subvert that, might be interesting to places to start thinking about this, where you'd go with that.
I think that the thing about this law is also from the other angle, from the state and how it perceives its, you know, its adversaries. You know, the argument, again, at this conference, but also in literature, lots of literature, is why did anarchist terrorism subside after the 1890s, when it clearly did, although there were outliers from certain places, or, you know, sort of violent acts, those kind of acts, what I call terrorism, you know, between the early 1890s, you had whatever it was, 12 heads of state assassinated, et cetera, et cetera, in a very short space of time. The argument is, in a way, that instead of imagining, framing anarchism as a mortal threat to society, the way that George Bush did or Teddy Roosevelt did in 1900, which was the idea of, you know, the evildoers versus the you know, regime of light and that kind of thing, almost using the same language 100 years apart. You know, you envisage it not as a cosmic war against terror, but as a police action, right? So, I mean, this was an argument actually some people made right after 2000. Don't go down this road because you're going to have endless wars. You want to frame it as a police action. And that's what people did, for instance, in Italy. The liberal government, which followed the authoritarian governments of the 1890s, Giolitti, what he said was, well, this is, you know, if these people break the law, well, we arrest them. But we don't arrest them because they're anarchists. We arrest them because they shot somebody or something like that. Or, you know, you just criminalize them. Or you also medicalize them, which is more interesting, with Lombroso, where you say, we're not going to try them because they're insane. So when Massetti, one of these, a man who shot during the Libyan War in 1911, an anarchist, shot his colonel, he said, I'm not coming, and he shot him, you know, everyone expected he'd be tried, right? And there would be a great trial about this, and it would be, you know, they said he was insane, and they couldn't, ahead of its time, and Foucault ahead of its time in some way, medical of the Soviet Union, you medicalized it as well. And then you incorporate people through anarcho-syndicalism or something, which the anarchists themselves agree to do, because they realize this isn't working, what you said. So actually framing it through law is a way that was done at that time. And also, it's the same discussion which followed after 2001 amongst state elites, you know, in the United States and Britain. And they didn't go that way, because George Bush and his friends, and he had a neoconservative agenda, and this is never waste a crisis, as their adversaries said a few years later, and that was a good crisis to carry on something else.
Okay, I've got about six people queued up. I apologise that I don't know everybody's names, but I do know Alex's. He's at the front of the queue at the moment.
Thanks. Cheers. Again, three really good papers. Chris, you really answered my how do we link anarchism to the global. I think you did that fantastically. I don't really have any questions or comments. I'd just like to say it was a great paper. For Paul, I'd like a bit more on how you link those three sections of the paper together. And I think it might help thinking, if you think through that, it might help you think about how anarchism can contribute to the sort of fields that you're looking at. And I think that links to the sort of concerns that anarchists have. Perhaps it helps us correct the historiography because you know about anarchism. Then what we know about anarchism as its principles and so on helps drive an analysis. But then that also helps drive the critique, the normative critique. Because so knowing anarchism helps you reposition or helps you give a different perspective on very traditional or emergent ways of understanding terrorism. And then finally for Carl, there's a problem with your categorisation of cosmopolitanism and 19th century anarchism, because I don't think they were cosmopolitans. In fact, Proudhon was quite critical of the so-called cosmopolitans, because this was a bourgeois ideology. I mean, he looked at Paris as this sort of cosmopolitan. He was critical of Paris as this so-called cosmopolitan city, precisely because it undermined the sort of regional autonomy of France. France as a regional collective. And so cosmopolitanism for him was something that was overriding these regional particularities, and he was very concerned to defend that communitarianism. And so I think the key focus for the 19th century anarchists was not cosmopolitanism but federalism. And I think that if you blur that distinction, I think it's a bit of a disservice to our historiography of anarchism.
Should we take those in the order that Alex gave them? Chris, do you want to go?
I don't think there was another question.
Oh, well, no. Yeah. All right, do you want to comment?
No?
Okay.
I think in a way what links certainly two of the three sections of the paper very plainly is that they all seem it's about people's perceptions of anarchism. And anarchism appears to be something that everybody seems to know what it is or what it's about, even if they actually haven't read that very much in the field, haven't been involved directly in it, but virtually everybody seems to have an opinion. And it rather reminds me of Salman Rushdie at the height of the Rushdie affair, gave his first media interview hidden away somewhere, and he commented that he'd become an absence. He was being talked about all the time, because he had no real say or control over the debate. And anarchism does appear to sort of fulfil that function for a whole host of different actors. And I think you need, at the very least, some basic knowledge. Or if not, you're going to make the types of mistakes that Lord Desai makes, as I say. Why IB Tor has published the book is beyond me, really. But that's the terrorism studies industry as well. Books like that can get published. And it's interesting with terrorism studies per se that Galvin, for example, who we cited, is a historian. Mm. So he just decided he could. This is where the action is, this is where the money is, this is where the publishing is. And so he moves across almost.
I think he did that almost off the top of his head. I don't know, he's a very distinguished historian of the Muslim world, and I don't think he needs the extra kudos, to be honest, but he was just doing it, But I mean, the problem with it, the history that I don't respond to you is that, and this comes very clearly in the discussions at this conference and all the literature which follows about this comparison of classical anarchism with Al-Qaeda, you know, you talk about structures and all this, that would make some sense in some ways. I mean, you could make some parallels in some strange way and do that. But I mean, they, of course, they have different ideologies, they have different theories. That's when it completely falls down. And that's the problem with Kelvin. He doesn't have a clue about the different schools of anarchism and all that. When George Eisenwine, my friend at the BN, that's what he was saying. You know, you don't know what you're talking about. The first party actually has some interesting things to say, and I might get back in a second, but let me just answer your question about cosmopolitanism. I think, first of all, to be honest with you, you know, this is the kind of the anarchist you look at, and you know, you know, your main man is Proudhon, and he has a certain way of looking at it. In fact, Malatesta, another anarchist of the era, actually was in a club called the Cosmopolitans. So he self-identified as a cosmopolitan. They had a little club in Longacre when he was in exile in the 1890s. The pub landlord was Tom Mann, another man who went around the circuits of capital, was, you know, organizing trade unionists from Britain to Australia, and various other radicals. So people did identify themselves. And I wasn't actually, you can use it as a methodology. Cosmopolitan in the sense that if you look at Marxism and the idea of the spread of a world system of capitalism based on the capital spreading beyond borders, breaking down Chinese walls, you know, the Communist Manifesto, you can say that one, if you want to examine the spread of really existing anarchism, which was anarcho-syndicalism essentially, which really attracted a lot of people, between roughly 1890 and 1914, you follow the circuits of capital, right? You follow the circuits of British capital, like Tom Mann. You follow the Wobblies, who go through the circuits of American capital, from the American West Coast down to South America or the Caribbean. You know, you follow this circuits of capital and circuits of migration, and that's a form of, you know, globalization, cosmopolitanism in that sense of the word, that was evident before the First World War, and of course has interesting parallels to similar developments since the 1980s in our own time. So I think really it depends on who you're looking at, but I think you have one point, which is the idea of marrying together this idea of a national or local cultural identity, a patriotism as opposed to a nationalism, as one theorist has theorized between these two points of love of country. And you, I didn't talk about that, but in the paper, in the combined paper that will be published, you know, with Saul's project, of course, I look at people like Landau who precisely do that, who are talking about, and Rocker for that matter. And so that was the aim of it. So I don't quite agree with you, and I think this is a central, you know, they try to square that circle. I say square the circle, it's very difficult to square. But you know what Landau has said. Landau has said that, you know, I'm an anarchist, I'm a South German, I'm a Jew, you know, I've got my multiple identities, I switch from, you know, from one to the other. So I think I would kind of disagree, and I think you've got too much Proudhon on your brain, really.
Paul, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I agree with the other question before about, you know, is the term terrorism really all that useful to an anarchist at this point? I really liked your paper because I had a class where, you know, political violence and terrorism actually was my textbook. It's ridiculous. I have much stronger words for it than you do. But I'm not as familiar with British politics and with British security understandings as I am with American. In the United States, you know, animal rights activists are labeled as terrorists, and I can't remember. I think it was actually on the Green is the New Red website a while ago, but there. You know, you can find quotes from Intel service spokespeople calling Timothy McVeigh a domestic extremist. So I think saying domestic extremist is less of a threat. I think that's the perfect way to put it. In a statist kind of term, a domestic extremist is less threatening, but that doesn't mean they're less deadly. You know, Timothy McVeigh killed a lot of people. We can argue about whether he was alone or not, but he killed a lot of people.
Yeah.
And he's called a domestic extremist by the government of the people he killed.
Yeah, we had a very interesting period in our history here in the 1990s, which was the times before 9/11, but post the sort of collapse of the Soviet bloc and the beginnings of sort of the Irish peace process. And ostensibly, Britain didn't have an enemy. And what you find in the 1990s isn't groups like MI5, MI6, or the regional special branches disbanding or facing big cuts. On the contrary, MI5 and MI6 built big new headquarters. And what they appear to have done is spun a lot of stories in the newspapers about far left, about far right, about animal rights extremists, and in particular about eco-terrorism, the big buzz term in the 1990s. And they talked up this threat. And I think they did so simply to maintain their budgets and to maintain their positions.
Yeah. This, of course, is...
Then Al-Qaeda comes along, and all of a sudden, we've been not just had our eyes on the wrong people, we've been watching the entirely wrong game.
Yeah.
You know, and in a way, that's one of the points Onnekis can make with the state, is they're not actually very good at protecting us.
Well, this is Chambers, Johnson, no blowback. You know, and I think, you know, blowback back to the 19th century, again, we have this Butterworth book, which is a popular account of all this, you know, where you have networks of people who are in the police, and there's a shady boundary between them and agent provocateurs and state interests, and sometimes you use anarchists to advance a state interest against another one, the same way that, you know, Lenin was used by the German state to undermine the Russian state. I mean, that's why they're letting through Germany. That kind of thing. That's going on in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s. And every state is playing that game. So that's another history which is interesting. They don't know where terrorism begins and, you know, where state terrorism begins, other forms of, you know, whatever you want to call it, because you don't know what, you know, you don't know where you're at, basically. Yeah.
And that has continued today. There's a British Muslim from Manchester, a guy called Hassan Butt, who had a book due to come out called Leaving Al-Qaeda, and sold his story, appropriately enough, in the News of the World. And it seems he was never in Al-Qaeda at all. He was a member of Al-Muharun, but just a complete fantasist. And eventually, the British state, he was arrested going off to Pakistan, and he admitted to the police he basically made it all up for the money.
The Ruth Kinner's multi-volume thing that she published, Routledge on Terrorism, tracks all the sort of the 19th century, early 20th century agent provocateur stuff.
Well,
worth having a look at that.
Yeah, I enjoyed all three papers, but I'm afraid the comments, questions are for Paul again. And one goes back to the earlier conversation about violence, and indeed to your paper, Chris, yesterday about anarchists and what they have to say today. Tolstoy's main insight is his critique of violence, but aside from the whole religious side, he's not really religious, he's just a rationalist. He likes Jesus only because he thinks what he said was rational, he doesn't believe in the supernatural stuff. And his main thing is his critique of violence. He's saying, we've got to stop it, it's clear, states are... And in fact, he says, he doesn't really talk of states, but he says, through states, we human beings are violent with ourselves, and that's what's the problem. But it's also, therefore, a problem with non-state actors. He's just a scathing of anyone using violence, although he'll say, you know, the revolutionaries are right, at least, in the cause, or more correct, as it were, and that's all they've ever been taught anyway, is violence. But that's the sort of stuff he'll talk about. So he might be an interesting anarchist there, precisely, you know, to shore up the anarchist critique of terrorism studies and all that. And the other point is on Islamo-anarchists and all that. I'm not that familiar with them. I'm more interested in Christian anarchists, but... I just want to make the point that perhaps it might be that they're a bit loony and it doesn't actually work, it's not internally coherent. Maybe you can't interpret Islam in that way, I don't know, and sure, they're protected in the West, so they can say what they say, and it's a lot easier that way. But what they do have to say, again, I think fits the sort of anarchist critique of those particular terrorists. And it's always interesting to listen to people from within the category that you have problems with, you know, jihadism or terrorism and Islam and all that, to see, you know, the voices within Islam that are critical of that terrorism. It might be that they don't go far enough as far as we're interested, but I think some of these guys, and even Mohammed Jean Venus, I think he's someone to add again to that anarchist critique of that area.
Yeah. There's much about there I'd agree with. I think what you do see with the Islamo-anarchism, and I'd recommend everybody just Google it and look at these, you know, the Facebook pages and Mohammed John Venuzzi's stuff. You can download as PDFs. I think again there is this element of cherry picking, and it's this usage of anarchism, of it being all things to all people again. And you know, you can find elements of Islam as a religion that are non-hierarchical. You know, that's there very, very plainly. There isn't a pope, there isn't that sort of central authority, with the exception of Shiism and the way Iran's developed in recent years. But that is more about politics, in a way, than it is about religion. the difficulty I think most anarchists would have with the concept of Islamo-anarchism is firstly that, you know, Islam means submission. You're talking about submission to God. That isn't a concept that sits very easily with anarchism as it is, regardless of the critique people would have of the shape many types of Islam have taken and positions regarding women or what have you. The second critique I think Bakunin made about the danger of working with political currents that are reactionary or slightly different to your own is that in any sort of marriage between anarchism and Marxism, they sort of suck the good bits out of you and give you the bad bits as a sort of great simplification. But you're compromising. What are they compromising? You know, if you look at the Conservatives and Lib Dems would be a classic example, but at the moment the Conservatives gain far more out of it, I think, than the Lib Dems do. There's a real problem with working with any non-hierarchical currents, really, that you're compromising. Are they really compromising?
Chris, I had a question about the legal framework and the state. It was pretty much obliquely answered before. It was basically, you mentioned that the Raytheon 9 kind of indirectly validated the state by waiting to be arrested and then, you know, going through the entire legal process voluntarily. But at the same time, they eroded the legitimacy of the law through their actions. Right? And you met the anecdote where they were playing cards when they were arrested. It actually kind of rings it's similar to ahisma, right? The Gandhian concept of ahisma, right? Just shaming your oppressor through volunteering yourself for bodily harm. So it wasn't really clear. Maybe we can talk about it later on. But I do see the affinities with the ontological approach. So, but yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh, I sort of have a half-formed comment that keeps changing listening to the exchange, but that's to do with exploring the relationship of anarchism and the law and how you in a way, disaggregated the operation of the law from the state, and really in practical terms, is the case you talk about an anomaly, or are there more cases, more examples of where there's been a successful use of that approach, trying to make a point by groups?
Which specific approach? Sorry, the getting off through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There were actually 15 last week got let off for doing something very similar at the same Raytheon office a couple of years ago. No, there have been quite a lot of successes, and obviously I can't remember any of them right now.
Tried to Plowshares.
Tried and Plowshares.
They've done
had a lot
two
of
or three times. Yeah.
Fast Lane. Less. Yeah. Has had a few, but less. And so there are examples. The Seeds for Hope women in 96 who smashed a Hawk jet that would have been sent to Indonesia and caused millions of damage and were let off. And so there is precedent. The problem is usually it goes the other way. And that's why I'm a bit cautious about putting too much hope in that. I think it's interesting the way people try to play it. They try to get juries. But I certainly think you're mad to assume that's going to happen. And certainly when I've done things, when my friends have done things, more often than not, the judge says, no, you can't use that argument.
Yeah.
So I think it's an interesting subversion, but I think it's something that you don't want to hang your hat on too much.
Can I just add that Adriana Sinclair is going to be publishing a book with Cambridge on its relationship of international relations and international law. She looks at tribal plowshares to try and unpack the relationship between activism and international law, and does a very good job of it. There's a plug for her. Adriana Sinclair is coming out. Next year.
Not a big UEA person.
Sorry?
She's a
UEA person.
I suppose my comment is to Chris as well, and kind of picks up on this last comment, which, I mean, I suppose I'm just saying in direct response to that it's a success regardless of the outcome of the legal case. And I think the really important tension that Chris is drawing out, and one that we really need to address, is how does direct action, which is successful in its own right, become rendered civil disobedience through the winning of a legal case, which then potentially legitimizes the state and the legal system, but can also be seen to subvert it. And there's, I mean, I don't know if anyone's read Living in Squalor and Eating Shit, which is like a zine, you know, a pamphlet that came out fairly recently, which was quite critical of the Edo demonstrators, and basically saying things like, if you put a Section 6 on the door of your squat, then you legitimise the state, because you're basically making recourse to a legal argument. Now, of course, this was, it was a classic, you know, anarcho-pamphlet polemic designed to provoke, you know, discussion. But I think it really relates to some of the stuff that Claire was talking about around the demand versus the act, and at what point an act becomes rendered a demand. So yeah, no, I just think that's a really interesting tension and one we need to talk more about.
And I also think it's where your comment in the panel before about the two being polar opposites was true in some respects, also misses the fact that often it's very hard to separate one from the other in a moment, and the Raytheon line are a good example of that. And what's interesting is the way in which the moment of the act, which is quite a, you know, a big act, and they had Raytheon in court going, oh, it was really annoying, you know, they set us back months, which was exactly the point they needed to prove their case, that we set them back months, so we did impair what they were doing. But they were very close to the act, it was quite powerful. But actually, to separate that from the power that how they turned their politics of demand, as we call it, and I don't want to make the catchphrase too secure, but how they framed that, part of it was also making the case to local people, using the media that generated, doing a lot of propaganda work about that, and they, like I said, they were very embedded in the local in Belfast. They made a lot of links between Belfast and the history of the Troubles and the equivalence between the Troubles and what was happening in Lebanon. And the Cana massacre was a big focal point for them, where I think 28 people from two families were killed, and they made a big link between that and Bloody Sunday. So, but they did all that through the court case and through these things, and so I don't want to separate the two out so much. I think it's the way they, and like you say, I still think there's a tension there that needs to be struggled with.
Daniel.
Yes.
Yeah.
This was prompted by something Carl said sort of in passing, but sort of thing leads to a oblique question or concern that others could speak to as well. So Carl, you mentioned about refugees and UN security forces and things like that. You know, it's better to have maybe those security forces at some points than nothing at all, you know, would be susceptible to other forms of violence coming in. So on the question of security forces, a brief story, I don't know if people have heard about something that had happened at the San Francisco anarchist book fair this past year. There was someone giving a talk on something to do with the myth of veganism or vegetarianism, sort of speaking against the emancipatory politics of vegetarianism and things like that. And a group pied the speaker with a pie that had cayenne pepper in it, temporarily blinding her. And so, obviously the big upset within the anarchist community, the sort of infighting within the anarchist community. And Colin Ward was giving a talk the next day, speaking to this issue. That so the woman, the person who was pied, was then going around with a petition to get signed, you know, saying this is horrible, this is happening, we need to stop this. And sort of the end of the petition said, we need to call the police because we have no other recourse to action. So, you know, he was giving this whole speech about, you know, police brutality, etc. And then leading up to this kind of effort, saying, what are we doing? We're anarchists, and we have to, you know, call the police in to deal with our own internal problems. So just a question on ideas of security, both internal security, and I think, what that could mean, whether that is necessary, how that could function within anarchist communities. And then also, following that, sort of with what Carl was saying about ideas of defensive violence, and how violence as a defensive measure, you know, to protect liberated spaces and things like that within anarchist communities can be rethought.
What do you want me to ask? I mean,
whoever wants.
I think Colin Ward is dead, but it couldn't have been him. But anyway.
Oh no! Sorry. It was it's coming to me. Sorry.
I mean, yeah.
Speaking of the brain.
But the point about that.
Ward Churchill.
Right. Okay. But what I was talking about obliquely was about Agamben's critique of the camp. This broad brush critique of the camp, where everything is Elstridge, basically. And it's very offensive, I think, in many respects. But that's for another place. But I just made the example of that there's something called, you know, a thick social good of security that people want, and that's something anarchists have to deal with. That's quite true. And I would say about security, if I could frame it back into international relations, get back to the general theme of the conference, is that one of the, you know, the anarchists historically have been successful when they've combined with some kind of populist movement or broader movement which involves taking some territory or something that's vaguely, you know, roughly anarchist, like Machno, the Zapata Mach 1, you know, if you look at that, if you look at the large spanses of territory in Manchuria in the 20s, early 30s, run by Korean and Manchurian anarchists. And, of course, the anarchists in Spain between 36 and 39. Now, in all these cases, what you have is, you know, them supping with the devil when it comes down to it, because they can square the circle. The most famous case, of course, is Spain, where, of course, the anarchists say, what are we going to do? We're going to make the revolution or defeat Franco. No one's going to give us arms in a world of nation states, you know. Why would nation states give anarchists arms, right? So, you know, the Russians will give arms, so they'll give it to other parties, which will weaken us. But, you know, what can we do? The point I make is that, of course, eventually these anarchists, and these are the left wing, so to speak, and these are the faistas, right? The faistas join the government, right? They become the famous government anarchists. So you see this, once you get to a position where you're talking about the real world of real power and real life and death issues, anarchism, really, when it comes down to it, is a form of nicer form of libertarian socialism when it, in the real world, you know, not in the world of theory, but in the real historical world of mass movements and in the global situation. And that comes back to what this conference is about, which is, again, global anarchy. Because in the world of states, it's impossible for anarchists to create that free zone without becoming something they can be called the anarchist state. I don't care what they're called. Unless you have an instant anarchist revolution everywhere, right, you're going to have to confront something that's a state object, right? If you're talking about complete revolution. Something else about, you know, forms of reform, which we talk about now in post-anarchism, that's a slightly different story. But in classical anarchism, we're talking about friend and enemy, to use a person I don't like, Paul Schmidt, but maybe appropriate in this context. I mean, there's no, how do you avoid it? You know, so that's the security conundrum for anarchists classically, when they've been successful.
Yeah, no, I'd kind of go a different way there and actually be very skeptical of how we engage in security and would very much go along the increasingly popular line in critical security work that actually part of critical security's project has been to challenge the notion that security is a realm divorced from international relations more broadly, and that whilst critical security studies should maybe exist, actually the normative value of security is very corrupted, and the binary between security and insecurity has a lot of problems in terms of securitizing moves often leading to insecurity, security being a totalizing and often in current discourses militarized force. And so, I mean, even just as a discursive move, I think I'd move away from the security-insecurity binary and look to politics and look to contestation. And then we can have the whole discussion through, you know, post-Marxism, post-anarchism, whatever. There's a lot in terms of how we play that out. But in terms of the discourses of security, I think there are quite compelling arguments from moving away from them as a depoliticizing force in any normative context.
Yeah, I think this is a really important question, and the thing I meant to say at the end of your paper yesterday was one of the ways we try to deal with the question of security in the anti-fascist movement would be sometimes to agree a chief steward on the day, that you would basically appoint one person, and if an instantaneous decision needed to be taken, you're relying on that person. And obviously, if they cock it up, they don't get asked to do it again. But also, I mean, to give you one example, I remember we did some work around the Bloody Sunday March in London a few years ago. And you had really diverse groups who were willing to protect that march from fascist attack, from London members of Sinn Féin, Celtic Football Firm, Red Action, and the anarchists. Now, you're never going to get those four disparate groups to agree. You could get the chief steward from each of those four groups to broadly agree on an action or on what to do if the police come in the pub and tell us to go, or fascists attack the pub, or whatever. So you can delegate authority. The question, obviously, is who you're delegating it to, and, you know, are you going to keep doing it, giving it to the same person if it works, because then you've got a problem of hierarchy or whatever possibly emerging.
Okay, I've run out of questioners. I apologise if I've missed anybody. I'm sure the panel would like to thank everybody for some really excellent questions. I'd like to thank you all for being very patient. And I think we'd all like to thank the panellists for three really excellent
questions. Lunch.